life isn't fair, is it? We wish it was, and the films and TV shows we watch try and tell us that it is, but the truth is that life isn't fair. The people that run the quickest don't always finish first. The strongest teams don't always win the competitions. That's why Leicester can win the league. Cheats win. Lovely people go hungry and have to use food banks. The richest people are not always those who deserve it the most, and the poorest people are not always those who deserve it the most. Footballers earn millions of pounds a week, while those who work the hardest, like pastors or teachers, seem to earn very little. Life under the sun isn't fair, is it? I'm sure we can all think of examples of it, and even worse, we can probably still think of examples of this. Bad things happen to decent people who we know and love. Life isn't fair. The Bible, thankfully, is starkly honest about that. Perhaps it's most clearly honest about it here in Ecclesiastes. In chapter 9, verse 11 and 12, a few verses before where we're looking at today, that's exactly what the writer, the teacher, the writer of Ecclesiastes says. He says that time and chance happen to us all. It can feel like there's no rhythm or rhyme to what happens. Life's unpredictable, and then one day we'll die, and it'll all be over. Life isn't fair. That's been the message all the way through Ecclesiastes. The question, though, that the teacher wants to ask us is, what do we do with that? If life isn't fair, and it isn't, how do we respond to that? How do we live? Well, here in these verses today, the teacher tells us that there are two ways we can respond to this life. He says we can be wise, or we can be fools. Wisdom or folly. And when we think of wisdom, it's very hard to get the correct meaning of it from the Bible's point of view, because we might think of wisdom meaning clever or sensible, and foolish just meaning like stupid and rash and immature. But when the Bible uses the words wisdom and folly, they mean something different. So what the teacher means in Ecclesiastes by wisdom is trusting that God is God and that we are not. Trusting him in every situation in our lives. Wisdom means trusting God to be God. He says elsewhere it means fearing him. That means wanting to honour him and please him above everything else. Folly, on the other hand, well, is not trusting that God is God. Now, that can mean outright rejecting him completely and everything and every claim that he has over his lives, and then looking for meaning in anything and everything else around us. Or it might just mean trying to control everything instead of trusting him. See, in the Bible, fools act like they are God and try to control and understand everything instead of trusting God above everything else. And what the teacher really wants us to see in these chapters here this morning is that wisdom is better than anything else we can strive for in this life. So in chapter 9, verse 13, he describes a city that's under attack, and it doesn't look good. Everything is in the favour of the attacking king. He's powerful. He's built huge siege works against the city. He's got all the weapons and resources he needs for his battle. And the city he's attacking has got none of that. It's small. It's got hardly any army. And yet the city is saved by this poor man. And in fact, the only thing this man's got going for him is that he's wise. This man trusts God above everything else. So he acts in faith. And he saves this city from attack. We don't know how, but that's what it says. And this story is here to show us, verses 16 and 18, that wisdom, fearing God and trusting him in every situation, is better than any other earthly power or strength. In verse 17, the teacher tells us we're to pay more attention to the words of those who trust in God than the shouts of anybody else. The teacher looks at life and says, this wisdom is so valuable. In a world which isn't fair, where we're not God and the times we live through baffle and scare us and hurt, it is far better to trust God over anything else. Wisdom, the teacher says, is better. But he also tells us that wisdom, being wise, is ignored. Have a look at verse 16. We shouldn't expect for our trust in God to benefit us in this life. We will get ignored. We will get mocked and overlooked and ridiculed. We are going to get no glory on this earth for trusting in God. Oh, if life was fair, then the people who honour and love God the most would be healthy, wealthy, successful, But we know that just isn't the case. We've seen that in our own lives, right? And instead, in fact, Jesus promises us, like this chapter says, that if we trust him, we'll be hated, we'll suffer, and we'll have trouble. So the challenge is, do we believe this? Do we value trusting God above everything else? Do we teach our children to trust God above everything else, over education, sport, money, success, happiness? Do we encourage each other to expect to be ignored and treated unfairly in this world if we live for God wholeheartedly? To put it another way, how does the way we spend our time and our money show this trust in God? Does what we encourage our young people to be most focused about reflect the importance of this wisdom? Are we more bothered about living wisely, trusting and fearing God above everything else? Or are we actually more bothered about exam results, career success, our relationship status, our reputations? Now, we're going to see later, those things are not bad in themselves at all. But the question here is, what is most important to us? Now, the teacher wants to encourage us that trusting God above everything else is better than any of the things this world considers to be important. Even when the world tells us it isn't and ignores it. So wisdom is better than anything else. Wisdom's ignored, but we also need to be careful because not only is wisdom ignored, it's also really easily spoiled. Very, very easily ruined. Chapter 9, verse 18 through to verse 1 of chapter 10. He says, wisdom's better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honour. Be careful, the teacher tells us. Little moments of foolishness, of madness, of sinful rebellion can seem to undo a lifetime of trusting God. He warns us, don't think of those sins that we're wrestling with. Anger, gossip, lying, lust, bitterness, greed, disobedience, materialism, drunkenness, swearing even. Don't think of those as harmless little vices that we can get away with dabbling in. We cannot. Each of those little flies of sin in our lives would have rot us to the core if it had the chance. Some of us know the impact of giving in to small temptations and the damage it can cause, either in our own lives or in the lives of people we know and love. A little folly can outweigh wisdom and honour. So we need to be putting all sin to death in our lives. Delete that app. Get rid of the phone. Quit that job. Stop that hobby. End that relationship. Fight the anger. Be accountable to others to help us fight, because all sin would spoil us completely if it could, and we are far more vulnerable than we ever like to think. Sin is never harmless, no matter how small it might seem. Like a tiny fly in a vat of oil, like a drop of poison in a pint of water, it's never harmless. The Apostle Paul says it like this in 1 Corinthians 10:12. If you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Because that's what foolishness is. An overconfidence in ourselves. So from here on in, the teacher focuses our attention on what a fool looks like, introduced by verse 2, where he says, the heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Now, this isn't a political dig. If you're a Tory supporter, you're not better than a Labour supporter. And it's not a slur on any left-handed readers. No, in Hebrew culture, the right side of a place symbolised righteousness, correctness, strength, honour. But the left side was a place of weakness and sinfulness and disobedience. So what he's saying here is that fools reject God and rely on themselves or other created things instead. And verse 3 tells us that we can see these sorts of people everywhere. Even now, we might be thinking of people we know, whether Christian or not, whether in this church or not, who fit this bill. But the real challenge for us this morning, what's much more important about this, is could this be us? Could this be you and me, even if we're Christians? Do we live as wise people, people of faith and trust and reliance on our good God? Or do we live like fools who think we need to control and manage everything ourselves? Oh, it's easy to see the foolishness in others, he says in verse 4, but it's far harder to see it in ourselves. So to help us, the teacher describes what a fool looks like. And he gives us 6 characteristics of the fool to help us. So firstly, verses 5 to 7, he tells us that fools are popular. Fools are popular. This world loves fools. This world is going to elevate and celebrate people who reject God for rejecting God. You don't need me to tell you that. Just look at our newspapers and TVs and those people that our culture makes as celebrities. People aren't celebrated because they're wise and God-fearing, are they? No, those people wouldn't make good contestants on Love Island. Now, verse 6, fools are put in many high positions while the rich occupy the low ones. Therefore, we can't think that just because we might be popular that we're not any different. In fact, if people around us aren't challenged or made uncomfortable by some of the values and the way we live our lives, if we just fit in with the world and the people we know, then perhaps we're being more foolish than we like to admit. This world celebrates fools. So how are we standing out? How are we different? Why do people enjoy hanging out with us? Is it because they can talk about those things that other less fun, less cool Christians would talk about? Or is it because we challenge them and encourage them to trust in the Lord and live for Him at all times? Fools are popular. And then verses 8 to 10, fools are all action. Fools are all action, but they don't consider consequences. So verse 8, this hunter digs a pit to catch an animal, but he's so focused on that he forgets about the pit and falls into it himself. Or a farmer, he sees a wall that needs removing, so he just does it without remembering the snakes that would nest in Middle Eastern walls, and he gets bitten. Now the teacher's saying here that we can know what we're doing, we can even know the best way to do it perhaps, but if we don't step back and wait and think about the consequences of what we're doing and ask God to lead us and spot any warnings, we're fools. And this isn't just in the big things like house moves and marriages. No, verse 9 tells us that every action has its danger. Even mundane stuff like breaking rocks and smashing wood. Things that are done every day in the Middle East. The teacher wants us to stop, think and pray. Get wise advice from people around us who we know trust God. Consider the consequences. When we think of what seems like even a good thing to do, do we still seek God's leading and guidance and wisdom first? Do we think of the consequences? Do we ask others? And then more importantly, do we listen to their advice? Will this thing take me away from my church family? Will whatever it is I'm thinking about make me less able to love my brothers and sisters at church? And in a culture that values busyness and action and results, this is so important to think about, isn't it? Our culture tells us, as long as we're busy, we're doing all right. And we can think that way about church. But the truth is, verse 10, it's possible to be exerting all our energy in keeping busy to try and find hope and status and meaning in our lives under the sun. But really, it'd be foolishness. We're working with the wrong tools. Fools are all action. And then thirdly, 11 to 14, fools self-promote. Verse 11, if you tell everybody you're a snake charmer, and yet you don't actually charm any snakes and they end up biting people, well, you all talk. That's foolish. No, fools want to build up their reputation with their good PR of themselves. But if they do for that for the wrong reasons, or even by saying we're doing good things without following through on it, if we tell everyone we'll pray for them, but never actually do. If we tell people what we're learning from God, but we never actually open our Bible or listen to others. If we say we're fighting sin, but in truth we just live how we want and never really think about it, then we're like this snake charmer, full of self-promotion with no reality. And it's foolishness. Verse 12 tells us these people are always talking. Verse 13, when they start talking, they hint at being foolish. You can probably pick it up a little bit. But when they continue more, they just compound it. And yet, verse 14, they just keep on talking. They never shut up. Fools think that they know everything, so they should talk and give you all the answers. Their PR campaign for themselves is never ending, but verse 14 tells us only God knows the truth. Only God knows the future. But the truth is, fools want to feel like they are God and not God himself. They want to look like they know everything, so they talk, but they forget that no one knows what's coming, only God. See, wise people point others to God. Fools point others to themselves. Could this be us? Is it possible that we can sing the songs here on a Sunday, we can quote the Bible, we can explain correct theology clearly, Yet we don't follow through with it and know and love God personally ourselves. Can we talk the talk about counting the cost, about killing sin, about picking up our cross and following Jesus, draw attention to ourselves, and when it comes to it, we're all talk. Never listen to others, and we never follow through. Fools self-promote. Wise people, God promote. Verse 15, we see fools never look weak. So because a fool likes to think they know everything, they won't even ask for help with something simple like the way into the town or the city. Fools promise to know so much, and yet they don't even know what they don't know. And they refuse to look weak in any way. Fools never look weak. And then verse 16 to 19, fifthly, fools are escapists. This picture in verse 16 of this immature king or a servant, it says elsewhere, it's not about that sort of thing. It's just somebody who he spends his life indulging himself. He's immature. He doesn't do what he should be doing. So he's getting up early with his mates, not to do the important work of ruling, but just to get drunk. He's distracting himself so much that he's actually being lazy. Verse 18, he doesn't do what he should be doing. He lives for this escapism. Every day is the weekend for him. The opposite of him is verse 17, a man who's prepared and who trusts God and is wise. He knows, verse 19, that all these things, money, feasting, wine, they are designed to be enjoyed. It's right to enjoy all these things, but they're there to be used properly. So he uses his money well. His roof doesn't leak. He doesn't see things in life as a way of purely enjoying himself for escapism. No, he enjoys them properly and uses them properly because he sees their gifts from God. That's what we were talking about earlier. It's not wrong to value education and enjoy education and all those different things that we talked about earlier. But if we abuse them, make them the focus of our dreams and our goals and our lives, we are abusing them. We shouldn't be abusing God's good gifts. And I say that as someone who struggles not to abuse the gift of food, for example. I eat far too often as an escape. I shouldn't be doing that. Neither should we be getting drunk. We shouldn't be using God's good gifts for escapism. This can be anything: work, family, social media, sport, friendship, TV, games, laziness, hobbies, anything. Use God's good gifts, but don't abuse them. So enjoy food well. Enjoy drink, even alcohol if you can do it without sinning, well. Use your money well. It is a good thing, and it's a good gift from God. Use God's gifts. Don't abuse God's gifts. That's what fools, that's what people who don't trust God do. They abuse them to escape their responsibilities. And then 60, verses 4 and 20, fools are angry and critical. Fools are angry and critical. So verse 4, fools quickly get angry whenever somebody annoys them or wrongs them or accuses them of being something they might think they're not. They kick off and they want to get vindicated. Verse 20, fools moan and grumble about everything that's going on around them, how others are always doing things they wouldn't do. Grumbling, complaining, negative. Or they might do it behind closed doors, but verse 20 tells us it might come out eventually. This is the verse where we get the phrase, a little birdie told me, from. See, fools are angry and critical. Yeah, the teacher tells us fools are all popular for all the wrong reasons. They're all action, they're self-promoting, and they never look vulnerable. They live for distraction, and they're prone to anger, grumbling, and negativity when things go how they don't think they should. Thankfully, though, that's none of us in here, is it? No, sadly, if you're anything like me, this description of a fool hits a little too close to home. I like being liked and popular. So do I always behave with the integrity of somebody who claims to love Jesus? I love to look busy, and yet how little time do I spend praying about something before I do it? I really hate looking weak and vulnerable. Yeah, there's a level of superficial weakness that I'll admit I struggle with food, but I really hate going deeper. I love to distract myself with food, music, comedy, family, whatever. And I am far too quick to grumble and get grumpy, even if it's only internally. Just ask Jamie. The stark reality is that even by these six brief standards, all of us are fools. None of us can escape from this. If a film crew were to just follow us even for a day, it wouldn't take long before they'd see our foolishness clearly. And yet most of us here this morning claim to be Christians. How can that be? How can we claim to be Christians and yet be clearly so foolish? Do you see yourself here in this passage? If so, good. Passages like this are here to wake us up. We are all fools, all of us. The danger is that we don't think we're fools, and we get complacent in our foolishness, and that little fly of foolishness is falling into our life, just waiting to rot. But if you do hear yourself this morning, there is good news. And the good news of Jesus isn't just for the fools who are out there and not in church with us this morning. It's for the fools in here. See, the realization that we're all fools leaves it perfectly clear that there is only one who is not a fool, and that is God alone. He is the only one who's fully wise. So this should cause us to realize that we are all foolish sinners deserving judgment. We deserve hell. None of us can escape that reality. But the only one who ever lived who wasn't that way is Jesus, God become flesh. And as we read the Bible, we see that Jesus is the only one who is truly wise, always righteous, always trusting God. He's the only one that trusted God and did what was right in every circumstance. You might have noticed that this chapter talks a lot about foolish rulers. Well, that's because the ruler was a picture of what the rest of the kingdom is like. The point is, all rulers, and so all people, are foolish. But Jesus, oh, he's the one wise ruler. Matthew 12:33 tells us that Jesus is wiser than the wisest king who ever lived, Solomon. Jesus was the only one who lived a life always saying no to sin and yes to God. Oh, we should live life that way. We saw that a few weeks ago, that God has made mankind upright, but we've all wandered off after our own schemes. Wisdom and following God is a wise way to live, but none of us can do it on our own. We're all fools. But Jesus died the fool's death. And Jesus took the judgment and the punishment of fools as he died on the cross. He died in the place of us fools, us who reject God and live life our own way and deserve judgment. He died in the place of fools, but he rose again from the dead so that foolish people can have the blessing of his wisdom. Now, this might seem messed up and ridiculous. How can that be true? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem fair. Well, 1 Corinthians 1:25 says, "The foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength." This might be baffling, but it's still true. So here's the good news from this chapter this morning. If we accept and recognise that we are all fools here today, then we can have hope and comfort in this life. We can grow. We can learn to live wisely and endure, even when we're overlooked and suffer. And we can have hope for eternity when we leave this life under the sun and go and meet Jesus. You see, he is the only one who was wise, and yet he lived and died so that we can be forgiven and brought back to God and know life now and forever. Then we can learn to give God back the place he rightfully has as Lord of our lives and learn to live life trusting him. That's what the first six verses in chapter 11 are all about. When we trust God, when we relinquish the place of God in our lives and stop trying to control everything, and we trust him above all, then we can go and live life wisely. We can trust him to be God. So we can invest in businesses, verse 1 and 2. We can plant gardens, verse 4. We can take risks because we accept we don't know everything, verses 5 and 6. But God does. And so we can trust him. So we can move like the Wickses to Ethiopia, or like the Wallaces to Nigeria, or even to Ayers Monsell, or even we can stay where we are in trusting God. We can share the gospel with our friends, neighbours and colleagues wherever we are, not because we know for definite that we're going to see fruit from that, or that God's going to use it to save people, but because we trust him for the outcomes. We don't know if our plans to grow a church in Ayers Monsell are going to result in a single person being saved, but God does. Lauren and Lawrence moving to Ethiopia, Matt and Lisa moving to Nigeria. They don't know if they're going to be dead within a year. But God does. And they trust him, and they're willing to take risks for him. Fools, verses 3 and 4, they don't see God in anything. So they either never take risks, or they just spend all their time worrying about the risks they have to take. But those who trust in God take risks for him, and trust him for the outcome. In a world that isn't fair, the truth is we're all naturally fools. But the wonder of the gospel is that God uses the foolishness of the cross to save us fools through his son's death in our place so that we can learn to live wisely, watching out for when our foolishness appears, which it will, but confident that Christ has already defeated it. And as a result, we can live for him, attempting great things for him and trusting him above all in everything we do.